The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Welcome to episode 2 of a new podcast, Cartels, Conspiracies, and Camarena. And I'm your host, Jack Llewellyn. I'm a lawyer, I'm an author, and I'm an investigator. For those of you who were here last week or listened to the last episode, you'll remember that we're leading up to the publication of a book that actually gets released on March 8th, a Tuesday. It's my book. It's entitled Someone Had to Die, and it details the Camarena case, the murder, and really talks a lot about the conspiracy issues surrounding the case and a lot of the allegations that have come out in the last couple of years. But before we really dive into the book, and in part waiting for it to be officially released, we started last week to try to set some baseline and say, all right, here's some facts we know to be true, and so that when we start looking at conspiracy theories and allegations and some other things about the case, we all have the same frame of reference and certain facts in mind. So, you know, we went through and we talked about the case. We talked about Agent Camarena. We talked a little bit about the history, how he was picked up, and those sorts of things. So this week, what we want to do is, again, one more episode to really get our baseline, get a set of facts that we all can agree upon. And so we're going to talk for a little bit about the traffickers. Who were the major players at that time? You'll remember that the term Guadalajara Narcotics Cartel never existed prior to Camarena's death. And so I'm going to try to avoid that, but we'll talk about the three or four principal traffickers at that time and have a little bit of discussion about their relationship, even though we're going to save a lot of that for kind of post-book discussions, because it really does enter into some of the different theories and ideas on how things occurred, and more importantly, why they occurred. But anyways, we're going to talk about a few of the major players. We're going to talk real briefly about the investigation and a couple of key facts about the investigation, which I think everyone can agree upon. And then we're going to touch just for a couple minutes on the three major American trials in the case. And that will then position us in a great spot to be able to talk in future episodes about the case, the conspiracy allegations, and really be able to analyze them with some academic rigor and, you know, with an objective towards finding out, you know, what the truth is as best we can understand. So let's start off talking about the major traffickers. One of the things you have to know and keep in mind, and this comes up in my book, we know more about 17th century people in England than we do about some of these traffickers who were born in the 50s in Mexico. There's very little information about most of them. Some of the information we have is contradicted by other information. We'll talk about Ernesto Fonseca in a minute, and I've seen different estimates on when he was born that range by as much as 14 years, and from reputable sources. So when we talk about this, we want to talk about them in a way where we get a basic idea of who they are, where they came from. The specific facts probably matter less. So with that, There's three major traffickers that get labeled as being the Guadalajara narcotics cartel: Rafael Caro Quintero, Ernesto Fonseca, and Angel Felix Gallardo. And we're going to talk about each of them. So the youngest, probably the most famous of that group, or infamous, and I will say, if you go to Guadalajara today, the one that everybody knows more than the others by far was Rafael Caro Quintero. Rafa was born in Sinaloa, probably in October of 1952. Poor family, farmers, ranchers, those sorts of things. He probably saw his father killed in front of him when he was about 14. And then shortly after that, he moved to Caborca. And we'll keep that name in mind for later on. But he moved to Caborca when he was about 16, worked as a rancher, worked as a truck driver. You know, again, kind of anything you can do in that area to survive. And then he got into the drug trade. He started working with a famous trafficker in that area by the name of Pedro Aviles Perez, who also worked with one Ernesto Fonseca Carrillo. Fonseca also was married to a relative of Caro's, and so there was a relationship there. In fact, as a side note, the DEA in Guadalajara, remember I said they never said the Guadalajara Narcotics Cartel, they tended to call them La Familia. And there's also, I've seen anecdotes that they may have referred to themselves as La Familia, because there's a lot of interrelationships. So Rafa starts working sometime around the age of 18, really gets into the marijuana trade, becomes pretty successful. Seems to have an affinity for it, for whatever that means. Growing lots of marijuana. He's alleged to have been one of the real pioneers in growing marijuana outside of the cities, way out in the deserts, frankly, in places that the anti-narcotics officials, whether that be the DEA, predecessor of the DEA, or Mexican government officials, really didn't think they could ever grow out there. You'll hear that he was the first and maybe the only one to do it. That's not true. There were lots of others. He just probably did it more successfully and on a larger scale than most of the others. In the late 1980s, he moves to, or in 1970s, excuse me, he moves to Guadalajara. Around this time, Felix Gallardo also moves to Guadalajara, at least part-time. Fonseca moves to Guadalajara. And there's a couple of different reasons for that. One is Pedro Alvarez Perez had been, some of the investigations against Perez had been pretty successful. There was a lot of heat in that area. And then, frankly, Guadalajara was nice. you know, where they were from in Sinaloa wasn't always that nice. Guadalajara was a beautiful city, great weather. Even to this day, you know, I was down there recently, and one of the people I was talking to is an expat from the U.S., and he lives just outside of Guadalajara proper on a lake with a lot of other expats. But he says he has neither an air conditioner or a central heating in his house. Never needs it. He has a little space heater once in a while, and he has a fan. That's it. So, again, beautiful city, big city, a good place to go if you are young like Rafa was, if you have lots of money and you don't want to be kind of in the poor areas of Mexico again. So he moves to Guadalajara, continues to expand his operations and to grow or develop larger and larger plantations for his particular brand of marijuana. As most of you probably know, Carl was, as opposed to Fonseca and certainly as opposed to Felix Gallardo, he was out and about. He was flashy. He was charismatic. He liked to go to the nightclubs. If you've watched some of the older television shows on him, you're going to the first one on NBC years ago, based off of Desperados by Lane Shannon. I think the flashiness shown there is a little bit overdone. I mean, he was flashy, but he wasn't crazy. But definitely was out and about and things. So this takes us to, let's say, the beginning of January 1985. And Rafa is in a great spot. You know, he's a big trafficker. He's got lots of money. In January 30, 1985, there's the incident at La Lagosta. And we talked a little bit about that last week. So that's where Walker and Radelat, two Americans, allegedly stumble into a restaurant where there is a meeting being held. And Carl Quintero either participates in or orders that Walker and Radelat be executed. And if you watched Narcos Mexico, the last season, you know, you see that played out. Again, we're going to hold off on talking about the degree to which the general perception is something that we think is accurate or not. But what we do know for sure is that Walker and Radelat were killed, and at least some people put the blame almost immediately on Carl Quintero and his group. Shortly after that, on February 7, we have the Camarena abduction. And then 2 days later, we have the incident at the Guadalajara airport. And that incident, we're going to talk about it in detail in a second, but this has been way, way overblown and totally misinterpreted in a number of ways. And we're going to, in the coming weeks, we're going to talk about that in great detail. What's wrong with the common perception? What do people say about it that's clearly wrong and that takes away a lot of their credibility? So hold on for that. But what we know right now is that Carl went to the Guadalajara airport, was on a plane getting ready to leave, and a small contingent of DEA agents, together with some MFJP officers, appeared at the airport, tried to prevent the plane from leaving, and Carl flashed some DFS credentials to the military in charge, and Pavon Reyes was the commander. Pavon Reyes eventually let him go. There is the story that Rafa stood at the door of the plane and said, you know, something to the effect of, next time my children bring bigger toys, and was flashing some type of weapon, probably an AK-47 that was gold-plated. Again, we're going to talk in coming weeks about that, about how Caro actually ended up there, how many people were actually involved in a standoff. Whether it was Caro is another issue that we'll talk about in different ways. But again, for our purposes now, we know that he was permitted to leave. We're told that he left Guadalajara, went to Caborca, where he visited family and stayed for a few days, and eventually fled to Costa Rica, where he ended up being arrested on April 4 of 1985. He was taken back to Mexico, eventually tried and sentenced, spent time in a couple of different jails. The story for all three of the main figures was that they were initially put into minimum security, where they had lots of privileges. That was eventually changed, and they were put into tighter security, maximum security prisons, where they had far less privileges. Late at night on August 9, 2013, Rafa was released by a judge in Mexico, essentially saying that he had served enough time for one of the crimes and could not be charged with another. The legalities are irrelevant, but he was released. And since 2013, he has been on the run. Obviously, he's on the DA's list as the number one priority. The Mexican police still want him, but he has been able to survive without being captured for the last almost 8.5, almost 9 years. He has done a couple of interviews in various places where he alleges, with varying degrees of conviction, depending on your point of view, that he's poor. He lives kind of day to day trying to avoid drones and other things. And that he has no involvement in the drug trade anymore. The DEA and others say that he likely formed the Caborca cartel after leaving or getting out of prison with his brother and some other family members. There's also been a number of allegations that he tried to kind of take over a new leadership role in the Sinaloa cartel, and that he was opposed in that effort by El Chapo, and then later by El Chapo's sons. Lots of back and forth on that, and whether or not there's a war going on, or a battle, however you want to describe the conflict, between Los Chapitos and then those that are loyal to El Mayo or to Caro himself. And one of the things that we will talk about later on is where the cartels stand today. But again, for our purposes of understanding kind of the sequence of events relating to the Camarena case and to Rafael Caro Quintero, that kind of takes you to the current day. So that's Rafa. The older of the three main cartel members was Ernesto Fonseca Carrillo, Don Neto, who was born in the same hometown as Caro, probably born in 1930. He had lots of drug experience in South America. He was arrested in Bolivia at one time. He appears to have had some involvement in the Camarena case, and without going into too much detail, because we will do that later, there are allegations that he was involved in some way, shape, or form in having Camarena picked up. Again, whether it was him specifically or Caro, we don't know, or don't know for sure. One of the interesting anecdotes that may be true is that when Camarena was taken to Lope de Vega, he was interrogated. Fonseca was there. That Fonseca left, went back to his home, came back the next morning, and found out that Camarena was either dead or close to dead. The story goes that he actually slapped Caro Quintero and said, in essence, you made this baby, you deal with it. And that he really understood the implications of actually killing a DEA agent. He fled Guadalajara and was arrested in Puerto Vallarta on April 7 with a whole contingent of people with him. It's alleged that he told people not to worry about it, that he was working with the government, and that's why a number of his subordinates and lieutenants were also arrested with him, and that they didn't flee when the arrest took place. One thing that's interesting, in some of the shows, you see Don Nato kind of portrayed as not well-dressed, you know, kind of almost hickish. And that really wasn't the case. He often wore a suit. I've talked to a DEA agent who met with him in a Mexican prison who said he was wearing silk pajamas at the time. He's also, I think, and some may disagree with this, as not being portrayed as overly bright, and people who knew him or dealt with him have said that he was very, very smart, and that you know, he may have been had a bigger role in kind of how things played out than is known. He was also put in jail. Again, he went from minimum security, silk pajamas, to a little bit of a harder life. He was granted house arrest and released in July of 2016. He's still in Guadalajara at his house. Every once in a while, you'll see pictures of him. You know, he's 92 now, so, you know, no real... no idea how long he will be around. Hasn't done press, you know, hasn't done interviews, has been very quiet since he's been on house arrest. All right, the third and probably the most influential of the three was Miguel Angel Felix Gallardo, El Padrino, the Godfather, or the boss of bosses. I like El Padrino better. So he was born in January of 1946 in Culiacán, Sinaloa. We know he went to high school. We know he took some college classes. And then after college, he became an MFJP officer. And at one point was assigned as a bodyguard for the then governor of Sinaloa, Leopoldo Sanchez Salis. And it was from that relationship that we think Felix really developed his skills as a politician, as a deal maker, as a peace broker. He's probably most influential in that he helped develop the routes to bring cocaine from Colombia and South America into the U.S. There was a point in time where most of the drugs that were going from South America, particularly from Colombia, into the U.S. went through Florida. And at one point, the DEA really started cracking down on those routes. And so there needed to be a different way to get things in. And with the help of some others who we'll mention in just a moment, Felix really developed the routes and the transportation and all of the logistics of getting mass amounts of drug. I mean, huge amounts from South America into the U.S. And what they did is they were able to take a cut. A large cut of whatever drugs they transported. And by doing that, they became hugely influential. And again, you know, Felix was really regarded as the boss of bosses, and he helped coordinate all of the activities. And one of the things he did is, you know, Mexico had the plaza system, so you had different bosses everywhere, and you all operated kind of independently. And that worked great when you were just kind of trying to sell what you manufactured or grew in your own little area. But when you had to transport stuff, there had to be arrangements, and there had to be logistics, and there had to be understandings. And Felix Gallardo was really good at this. After the Camarena killing, and we'll talk a lot about his role in the Camarena killing, but what I can say absolutely factually is in most of the early documentation on interviews with witnesses, people who alleged they were there. Felix Gardel is not named as being at Lope de Vega during the interrogation of Camarena. We also know that Sergio Espino Verdín, who probably was involved in the interrogation of Camarena when he was first arrested, he said that Felix Gallardo was not at Lope de Vega and had no role in Camarena's abduction. Now, Espino Verdín, the next day after being interrogated, and if we were doing this video, you could see the air quotes around interrogation, but after being interrogated, Espino Verdín remembered that Felix Gallardo actually was there. Nevertheless, he was implicated in it and in the murder of Agent Camarena. He was eventually arrested in Guadalajara on April 8th of 1989. He also was put in jail for a little while. He was able to kind of maintain his position as the boss of bosses while his conditions were, again, mild. He eventually was moved into maximum security, and that really led to the dismantling of the cartel and the arrangements between the different plaza leaders, and led to kind of this boom in different cartels in Mexico, and in some respects, the wars between the cartels. We're going to spend a lot of time in a couple of episodes in the future talking to a former DEA agent who's going to explain in great detail how this dismantling of the system that Felix Gallardo had helped create has led to many of the tragedies that we see in Mexico over the last few years involving the cartels. Felix Gallardo gave a recent interview on Univision. It was, in my mind, an attempt to show how disabled, how ill he is, and to get house release like Fonseca. I don't think he did a very good job. And he also said that he didn't really know Carl or Fonseca, and said some other things say that he had no involvement in Camarena, that I think he didn't pass the basic line of credibility. If he was trying to gain sympathy, I don't think he did it the right way. Okay, those are the three that are generally known as the leaders of the Guadalajara cartel. One other one that we need to talk about is Juan Ramón Mata Ballesteros, who was a Honduran born in about 1935 in Honduras. He became a drug dealer in Honduras. He had great connections with the Cali and Medellin cartels, and he is primarily responsible for introducing the South American drug dealers to Felix Gallardo and setting up that relationship. He was indicted in 1984 for a huge smuggling ring in Van Nuys, California, and another one in Arizona. One of the things we're going to spend a lot of time talking about in the next couple weeks is Setco, which was an airline that probably, or at least allegedly, was owned by Mata Ballesteros, that was used by the CIA in activities relating to the Nicaraguan Contras. So again, we'll talk a whole lot about that. He was implicated in the Camarena case. He initially was convicted in a trial that we'll talk about in a second. based on some hair testimony that his hair was found at Lope de Vega. We know that he was in Mexico City a couple of days after the Camarena killing, and that he was allowed to leave, or said better, the DEA and Mexican officials were kind of held off for a couple of days before they raided where he had been. And then he was able to escape. Fast forward a couple of years, in April of 1988, he was arrested in Honduras, put on a plane, sent to the Dominican Republic, and then to Puerto Rico, where he was arrested by U.S. Marshals and then eventually brought to Los Angeles for trial. He was convicted in 2017 in connection with Camarena. He was also convicted separately with respect to those the Van Nuys and the Arizona smuggling operations. He eventually, the charge relating to Camarena was dismissed for reasons we'll talk about later, but basically the hair fiber analysis from the FBI was called into question, as was the principal witness against him. He remains in jail because of the drug charges from the Van Nuys and the Arizona operations. He currently is at the U.S. Medical Center for Prisoners in Springfield, Missouri. To the best of my knowledge, he's given very few, if any, interviews to the media. I have spoken with him, and I've spoken with his family, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. But his involvement and his role is interesting, and when we start talking about how things developed with the cartel and how things developed with Camarena, he becomes a lot more important than I think others assumed. One other thing I want to mention with respect to the cartel, and you know, again, I hate that word, but it's the easiest way to describe it. There were lots of others. Many other people around at the time that were involved with one or more of Camarena and Felix Gallardo and Fonseca. And so to suggest that it was just these three would really be doing an injustice to it. It also would be completely wrong to think of these guys as joined at the hip. One of the things that we'll talk about when we start looking into some of the allegations, but in 1985, early 85, and late 84. So let's go back to 84. Let's say in 84, there were some DEA reports talking about the cartel, and the operations, and specifically talking about Felix Gallardo's operation. And Caro is barely mentioned at all in there. There's a later report talking about Caro's operation, and Felix Gallardo's not mentioned at all. So again, you know, there's this term, the Guadalajara Narcotics Cartel. They didn't sit down and get together every day. They didn't have, you know, board minutes. They didn't have meetings. They really worked. They were, there's a lawyer who had represented, people in both Medellin and the Cali cartels, and said at one time, you know, there are no cartels. They're drug dealers. They cooperate when it's to their benefit, and they don't when it's not. So we wanted to talk for just a second about the investigation. A couple of things to keep in mind. We talked last week about the missionaries who were killed. We talked today again about La Langosta. Keep in mind, both of those were investigated by the Mexican police and not at all by American officials. Okay, DA had no involvement. Camarena gets killed and almost, or kidnapped, sorry, and almost immediately a number of DEA agents from across America come down to Guadalajara. The FBI comes down. There are people everywhere. But the investigation is still hampered because there's only so many things that the DEA is permitted to do. And so one of the things we know, for example, is that Lope de Vega had been scrubbed, for lack of a better term, prior to the DEA being allowed to investigate. Even after that, the FBI found certain things, including potentially hair fibers. They found at least one syringe. There were other things that they found, but the investigation was really, really limited based upon, again, the scrubbing, the things that had occurred, and that happened over and over and over again. We talked about Sergio Espino-Verdin, who was deeply involved with the cartel, had great information, but the Mexican police controlled the investigations and the interviews with him. So in many respects, all of the investigation done by the Americans was limited and hampered, and as a result, there are holes. There are gaps in information, and that's always going to be the case. One of the other things that I find really interesting is that in all the time, you know, so February of 1985, we're 2022, so that's 37 years and a month from today, or tomorrow, I guess, but very few people have talked. You know, you still don't get Caro Quintero saying, "I'm an old man, I'm ready to tell everything that happened." Nobody really has talked. And I know for a fact that that the current DEA folks working on the case have found similar things with witnesses who are literally on their deathbed, who say, "Not going to talk, I'm going to take it to my grave." In the United States, there have been three trials, three criminal trials that were related to the Camarena case. The first one was in 1988, and that one was Rene Verdugo, Jesus Felix Gutierrez, and then Raul Lopez Alvarez. Those were the main defendants. Those cases were more circumscribed. They were based upon, again, some of it on the hair evidence. All three were convicted. We'll talk a little bit about Rene Verdugo in particular later on. But those cases, in a lot of respects, were more contained and less notable, again, for lack of a much better word. Then there were two trials that involved Ruben Zuno Arce. Ruben was a Mexican politician, brother-in-law of the former president of Mexico, may have been involved with the drug traffickers, lots of different allegations. But his trials became a lot more notable, again, in part because of his relationship to Mexican politicians, but also because the nature of the case changed dramatically. Now we're talking about a large conspiracy. We're talking about conspiracy meetings. We've got a witness who's willing to describe all of the different things that happened. So the case is much bigger, much more newsworthy. The first trial starts in, or is in 1990. We call it Zuno 1. He was on trial with Mata, with Juan Jose Bernabe Ramirez and Javier Vasquez Velasco, all of whom were convicted. I tell a story. I sat in that case or in that trial at various times right next to Mata. And I had grown up in a small town in Colorado, went to University of Minnesota for law school, and honestly, sitting next to Mata Ballesteros for several days during trial was, at the time, the scariest thing I'd ever done in my life. So anyways, that trial goes on, and then, and everyone's convicted. Zunel gets a new trial. We're going to go into these trials in great detail coming up. But for our purposes today, Zunel gets convicted. He gets a new trial based on prosecutorial misconduct. And really what happened was the AUSA on the case, Manny Medrano, had said that a certain piece of evidence should be admitted and that he was only using it for a limited purpose. In closing arguments, he probably used it for a different purpose. The court found that that was prejudicial and ordered a new trial. That case went up to the Ninth Circuit. The Ninth Circuit agreed, sent it back down. And in 1992, there was a second trial, the Zunel 2 trial, where Zunel was tried with Dr. Humberto Alvarez Machine, who had been a doctor who hung around with the cartel or with the traffickers, who may have been at Lope de Vega and may have administered drugs to Cam Moreno. At least that was the allegation. He becomes famous because he was basically kidnapped in Mexico, taken to the U.S. and dropped, almost literally dropped on the runway in El Paso. Lots of issues with respect to him. His case went to the U.S. Supreme Court a couple of times. He ends up getting, there's a directed verdict after the case against him with the district court judge finding that the government really had presented no evidence sufficient to find that he had committed the crimes. And he has, he was then released, sent back to Mexico, where he lives today. He's in Guadalajara. He owns a taco restaurant. They call it a taco stand. I've been there. It's not a taco stand. And then Zunel was subsequently convicted. His appeals at the Ninth Circuit and the U.S. Supreme Court, and then subsequent appeals at the district court level were all denied, and Ruben died in jail a few years ago. So what have we done now? We have now gone basically from pre-Camarena, the DEA in Guadalajara, through the trials to say, here are the facts we know. And I appreciate everyone's indulgence in getting us to this point, but I think it's going to be really important when next week we start talking about the things that I present in my book. Again, Someone Had to Die comes out on the 8th. But what we're going to do is we're going to start talking about the major theories, the major controversies surrounding the Camarena case. We're going to talk about Narcos Mexico and how it was developed and some of the things there. We're going to talk in great detail about The Last Narc on Amazon Prime. We're going to talk about the role of the CIA. We're going to talk about the role of Felix Rodriguez, if there were any. We're going to talk about some bizarre coincidences, some amazing things that occurred during and between the Zunel trials. We're going to talk about allegations made with respect to Jaime Kirkendall, who was Camarena's boss in Guadalajara. We're going to talk specifically about Hector Boreas and the claims he's made, and we're going to The goal here is to take the facts we know, evidence that we haven't talked about yet, and really analyze things, okay? And not take everything at face value. And then we're also going to talk about Godoy Lopez and Ramon Lira, who are the main witnesses, again, in air quotes, from The Last Narc. And then, as I mentioned earlier, we're eventually going to get to, we're going to talk a lot about the cartels today and kind of how they got to where they are. During all of this, we're going to have some guests. We're going to have a couple of DEA agents. We're working on a couple of witnesses whose names have been mentioned earlier. There's some logistical issues in getting them on. My hope is that we eventually get Agent Bareilles to come on and talk to us. And we'll have some others. So, going to conclude today. Really appreciate everybody following along for these two. And I think things are going to get more interesting. And frankly, I get excited. They're exciting issues to talk about going forward. And we will do that in the next episode of Cartels, Conspiracies, and Camarena. Thanks for joining.